Welcome back to Corporate Rehab. So we are picking up where we left off last week, which is talking about DEI and, you know, how it sort of interacts and intersects with everything else that has that businesses do. So hi, Nami.
Hi, Michael.
So where we left off last week, we were talking a lot about, you know, companies kind of struggling to say racism is bad. We were talking about some of the racist stuff that's happened to Nami. But Nami, I'm curious, you served in some DEI capacity in the company that we were in. So I'm curious if, like, you talked a little bit last week about what your experience was like with that, mm-hmm. but I'm curious of, like, did you feel in the moments that you were kind of dealing with those things that, like, did you actually think that there was progress being made? Or, because I know in hindsight, it's really easy to look back and be like, okay, this was just lip service. Mm-hmm. There was truly no actual plan, no real focus on a lot of it. So I'm curious, like, in the moment, was it happening? Because it happened very, very quickly. Was it happening so fast that, like, you just kind of thought, like, okay, they're actually listening, it's getting better? Or did you kind of know even then that, like, it was not going to go anywhere?
I think it was a bit of both.
Okay.
And I will also want to be fair that, you know, this social unrest really happened, you know, while we were at home,
yeah.
right? You know, during the pandemic. And so a lot of the responses that we had, you know, perhaps could have been better if it was face to face. I don't know. It is hard because I know there are definitely some people who've put forward the effort to organize a DEI within an organization that wasn't necessarily putting DEI at the forefront. And one of the things that I've been thinking about a lot is, you know, these organizations, corporate America, putting this DEI initiative as part of their culture, whatever it is, you know, I think it's kind of interesting because being diverse and being different is just who we are, right?
Right.
Michael, you as a queer man, me as a Korean American woman, it's not something that just because now there's a corporate agenda for it, you know, any part of our identity really changes.
Right.
It is who we are fundamentally as people. And as people, when we worked at, you know, the companies that we've worked at, sometimes, you know, in the roles that I've had, you know, I sometimes just had to downplay because...
Yeah.
And keeping that part of myself as being invisible, and, you know, trying to be quote unquote more white,
right?
Like, again, one of those things of, you know, you have to promote yourself, you have to talk about your achievements, you have to talk about, and again, I mentioned that in a previous episode of, in the beginning, I was just not comfortable with that, right? And then, you know, even in the workplace, I worked for an organization that was mostly white and getting confused with this one other Asian girl. I think the entire organization had maybe 3 Asian American women and just constantly getting confused with this other person to a point that when I got promoted, IT actually changed her title instead of mine.
Mm.
I would meet people and they would address me by the other person's name. You know, people are having conversation about, you know, promotion conversations. And I only found out in hindsight, but that they were talking about my achievements as part of her achievements. And, you know, especially as an Asian American woman or Asian American, people think that we all have this good stereotypes that plague, that cater to us, right?
For sure.
Which, you know, regardless of whether it's good or bad, it's still harmful.
Yeah.
Right? Where I remember one of the managers said, you know, can you hire someone like you and this other person? Oh, you want me to go hire Asian women?
Oh, wait, that's what they meant?
Yeah. I mean, I didn't say that out loud, but that's what they meant. They liked our work ethic, and they associated that with, Asians are good workers, so therefore we need more Asians on the team, right? Right? And you're like, huh. And then, I remember one of our coworkers as he was leaving, who, by the way, white male, and I'm not trying to, single white men out,
yeah,
but he said, don't let the Asians take over, right? Because, and so you kind of think about these comments made in the workplace, you think about how you are viewed in the workplace, and it's just crazy that now that you put this DEI on the map to say, oh, we are, actually going to do something about it, whatever it is that you're going to do, it doesn't add anything to our identity. We've already had it. We've already experienced it. We've lived through it. We're living it, yeah. Right? And so I think that's just interesting of how it's not just about, having it in place, but how do you truly make a place feel inclusive when you're having incidences like this in the workplace, which is so not okay, right?
Yeah. You know, you talked last week about a specific person. Mm-hmm. I can't remember if it was a specific incident or multiple incidents. I think it was just one where you were in college,
mm-hmm.
and someone was questioning your abilities in English.
Mm-hmm.
And you had made a comment, I think you said it a couple times, where that person did not graduate, enter the workforce, and magically become, this.
Or maybe he did. I don't know.
It's unlikely, though. And I can think back to instances, especially when I was working in beauty retail specifically, that I had a manager, a general manager, in one of the locations I worked at, that every time Black teenagers or Black women would come into the store, they would immediately be like, get on them. And, mm-hmm. and this would be over the walkie-talkie. So, and we all had like earpieces. So yes. It wasn't like Target where you can hear everything. Like, it's just in our ears. It was a tricky thing because, the general managers were my manager. I obviously had a reason to watch them. They had not given me any reason to watch them. So I would always go over, greet them to kind of just be compliant and say, okay, sure, I'll look at them. And so I would go over and be like, hey, what's up? And they'd be like, oh, we're just looking around. And be like, yep, cool. And I would walk away. And finally, I was doing this general manager's hair maybe a week after one of these incidents. And I mentioned it to her to be like, what's going on here? Mm-hmm. Like, why do you keep doing this? And what she actually said to me was, if they didn't want to be watched or didn't want to be followed or whatever, then they would tell their friends not to steal when they come in here. Which, first off, were we a high shrink store? Yes, we absolutely were. Yeah. We had a lot of theft. But the only people I can remember catching in the act were white women.
Mm-hmm.
What our loss prevention at the time was telling us was the profile for shoplifters was white teenage girls. So, and he never even said, watch white teenage. He was just saying, he was, if anything, was like, stop watching everybody. Mm-hmm. If you notice something, like if they're bad at shoplifting, you're going to figure it out very quickly.
Yeah.
And there was one woman I can think of, and we never knew her name. We called her eyelashes because she had these really huge, thick eyelashes. But we knew every time she was coming in, she was going to start stealing. And it got to the point where the second she would come in, we would start following her around. And after a while, she'd start offloading the things that she was stealing and throw them into shelves. Very blatant about it.
Wow.
But half the time, like if we noticed a fragrance case had some things missing, when we go back on the cameras, it was generally white women, and they worked so fast. Like, there was no amount of watching. The other thing, too, is they didn't care. Mm. Because they were going to be on the freeway and out of there in 3 minutes. Way before anybody was
They're professionals.
Yeah, like, and there were times where literally, like, crime rings would come in, clear out entire fragrance tables, and take off. And you know, you're just stuck to sit there and watch.
Yeah.
So anyway, the whole point of this story is kind of exactly what you're saying. The general manager, to me, lost cause. There was no talking to her. Yeah. I had attempted. It went nowhere. I had reason to believe that the district manager of that particular location was going to feel very, very similarly. And so I just said, you know what? I'm not going to talk to you about it anymore. And I would just basically coach the staff anytime this would happen.
Yeah.
Of like, you absolutely do not do that.
Yeah.
Like, and I would kind of tell them, like, this is what I do. If she's on me and telling me I have to go do something, sure, I'm going to give the appearance that that's what I'm doing.
Yeah.
And I'm going to try to make it as least bad for everybody, you know, that has to be involved in this situation. And that's my whole thing, though, is I was more worried about the people who were working there as their first job, or people who wanted to move up, you know, in the store and become a manager. I was so worried about that type of thinking becoming commonplace in that store that I was just trying to do everything I could to combat that.
Yeah.
I don't know if I was successful. I don't interact a lot with the people from that company anymore. But, you know, it's, I just think... I think especially as white people, we really don't realize how much of what we learn when we're younger is just part of like our brain.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not giving anyone an excuse. I'm not saying anyone is beyond growth. But, you know, I talked last week about it does take time and effort and correction, to be honest, to like address and overcome implicit bias, especially I think when it comes to race. And I've been very lucky to have friends and former partners who were really integral in like just helping me understand that and breaking that down.
Mm-hmm.
Because to me, being racist was like calling people slurs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like in my mind growing up, if I wasn't saying the N-word, which I've never said, I wasn't being racist.
Yeah.
But there are like so many other ways to be racist.
Right.
And I think, you know, to talk about DEI, like all of that is just an effort to sort of dissipate these issues that we have in our overall society. Because, you know, if racism wasn't prevalent in our society, especially in the US, DEI programs would be much less needed. Are there other things that DEI covers? Of course, but like a lot of it is rooted, I believe, in race and then gender, and then I think sexuality comes after that. But I think that we don't often realize how much of that just becomes like core memory, and something that we really need to try to overcome later down the line.
Yeah, and I think that's anyone, right? Of whether, regardless of your background, you know, what you experience as a child obviously influences your thinking.
Yeah, and absolutely.
Your experience shaped the person that you are, right? And so I think, one, it is also coming from a place of there are a lot of things that I don't know. For example, you know, Hispanic, such a huge part of the U.S. population. I don't know a whole lot about that particular, you know, ethnicity. What, you know, there are obviously different facets that, you know, ethnicities that make up what is called a Hispanic group, right? And, you know, when these organizations, these corporations say, you know, we want to target the Hispanic audiences, right? You know that it's not a monolith of this group that's just called Hispanic,
right?
But when it comes down to really understanding the ins and outs, the differences, the cultures, like, I don't know that. And you know, the first step is like saying, I don't know what I don't know. But then two, being willing to open to find out and saying, you know what, I may have some previous ideas about what this group is, but I'm willing to find out, like, new information, right? And new information that may contradict contradict my current beliefs.
Yeah.
And so I think it's just this, and I think the conversation of DEI gets to be so tricky because people don't necessarily want to talk about it, right? They want these classroom style workshops and, you know, kind of being talked at.
Yeah.
But there aren't real conversations happening. And to your point, Michael, you said you've learned because through your conversations with people, right? Yeah.
To be honest, through correction,
mm-hmm.
and it sucks. I'm not gonna lie. I'm not gonna sit here and pretend like doing that work is like fun. Mm-hmm. It sucks, mm-hmm. and it really makes you come to terms with the fact that, like, yeah, at times I have been really racist.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't mean to, and again, mm-hmm. I thought at the time because I wasn't calling anyone a slur that I was fine. But like, it was realizing that racism is a lot more than that. It's mm-hmm. you know what you were talking about with being asked about your English capabilities, mm-hmm. or you know, I have witnessed a conversation one time where this guy, it was a group of us,
mm-hmm.
And this guy goes to the one Asian guy in the room and is like, oh, what martial arts do you know? And which was already a weird question, but then clarified it with, oh, I'm just asking every Asian person I come in contact with.
Oh, that makes it better, right?
I know. Yeah. And everyone in the room was just kind of like, what is happening?
Yeah.
And this particular person was like a boyfriend of a friend. And we're all looking at the friend to be like, you need to get him together. Like, this is not... But it was just that, like, moment of, like, I think, you know, none of us, including the person that had asked the question, wanted to, like, ruin the night, which totally could have been his prerogative, and I don't think anyone would have held that against him. But it's just that, like... yeah, that notion of like if you're being corrected, 9 times out of 10, it's just to be corrected. It's not to attack someone. It's not calling any. I've been called racist, sure, but like never in a way that like I knew was like a serious, like,
right.
You are a racist person. But I've had people sort of gently be like, hey, I understand that you think this thing is either okay or funny, or especially when I was young and trying to be a comedian, like there were a lot of things I didn't quite understand, or nuances, mm-hmm. or things I didn't think I shouldn't have been saying, whatever, that yeah, in hindsight are like horrifying and things I would absolutely never say now. But it's just that like idea that I had to learn to be okay with the correction. And I think that's where, though, with DEI, it's what you're talking about is like people want a classroom. They want, you know, they want like formal education. And that goes a distance. I'm not going to say it doesn't. But I think the ultimate issue ends up being it's really easy to take that information in. What is not as easy is to take the information, say, okay, how does this specific information apply to me?
Mm-hmm.
And then apply it.
Right.
And I think that's where like affinity groups or whatever you want to call it,
mm-hmm.
tend to miss the mark, because it has a lot less to do with how does this marginalized group and their experience interact with myself? And it becomes more about just like, here's a marginalized group. This is kind of what they're about. Here's some education on them. But it doesn't really teach me what my biases may be toward that group, how to overcome those biases, and also like why the biases are harmful.
Right.
And I know, you know, you were involved with affinity groups. I was not.
Mm-hmm.
And I like I rejected them. Mm-hmm. I did not like them. But part of it is because my like relationship with like being queer or whatever is just, to be honest, like not a corporate friendly, like I take queerness as more almost like an act of rebellion.
Mm-hmm.
Not that like, I don't know how to explain this. I guess my, like the, when I think of queer, I think of like Stonewall, like that type of like, if something needs to be done, sometimes you have to burn some things down. You know what I mean? Like that is how I approach change, because I think we have seen time and time again that just talking doesn't usually move things forward. Now, I'm not saying I was ever going to burn down any buildings. I'm just saying <I hope not. laughs> that, you know, for me, like, going live on Instagram to, like, talk about coming out is not going to do anything. Mm. I think it needs to be a little bit more radical, possibly a little bit shocking even, because sometimes that's just what you need to, like, really understand someone else's point of view. And so, you know, all of that to say, I was not trying to join DEI groups or the affinity groups. I had been sort of, I'd been taken off of things because mm-hmm. of my refusal to do it. I was like asked to host something. I was like, yeah, sure, whatever. And I was just asked to host because I had the capability to do it. And then I was taken off ultimately because I refused to join the DEI group. Mm-hmm. And I was just like, I don't know. Is that not backward?
Yes.
Like to exclude someone within the affinity. I to this day, it's something I still think about sometimes. Because I remember the person who had asked me to do it, mm-hmm. who had to come back and say, hey, I'm really, because I had already started working on it. Yeah. And they came back and they're like, hey, I'm really sorry, but you can't do it. And I was like, okay, whatever. And I still ended up helping with it. I still ended up, because the person that did do it didn't have the experience. And mm-hmm. so, and I didn't want to see them fail. And so, you know, I still ended up helping, but it was something that at one point was actually in my exit interview. And I ended up taking it out because it wasn't a reason I left. I was at that point just sort of unloading without thinking about it. But it had made it into my exit interview initially because in my mind was like, well, this is still a barrier. Like, this is still, I think, an example of like, you're trying to implement changes, but there's like no actual anything happening. Like, the audience was never clear. Like, it just, and to what we talked about last week, it was in response to other things. We saw a lot of changes happen on the leadership team. We saw, you know, the formation of these affinity groups or reformation because they had existed and they went away and they were coming back. But the thing is we got, what, 6 months out of that? And suddenly the leadership team pretty much went back to exactly what it was the summer before. The affinity groups at this point, I obviously don't know what's going on with them, but most of the leaders of those groups at some point had resigned, or at least the ones I can think of had resigned, whether they resigned from the company or were just like, this isn't worth it for me to keep doing this. And so, you know, it's just, to be honest, I don't know what the fix is. I don't know if there is a fix, because I think it's a deeper societal issue than I think, well, like what corporations can fix.
Yeah. And, you know, to speak to that experience a little bit, I was the leader for the Asian Leadership Affinity.
Yeah, so I wasn't going to out you on that.
for me specifically in leading that group, I think it was important to hear the voices of the Asian employees within the company. But I think where we missed the mark was, it's not, you know, if we just talk amongst us, we're just talking amongst us.
Yeah.
So how do you then get other people involved so that people can listen to what it is that makes us us? Like, you know, what are the struggles that some of your other Asian American employees are going through, or Asian employees are going through? Because we also had a session in response to API hate that was going on. And, you know, while that was like a good session to have, a part of me felt like, yes, we can talk about this, but at the time, not a lot of, or I don't know how much, what was the percentage in the organization that knew really what was going on. Yeah. I think you and I tend to care a little bit more about social issues than some others. And so, you know, honestly, for some people, if it doesn't impact them, it doesn't, you know, it's just kind of like ignorance is bliss, right?
Yeah.
And so I think there needs to be yes, people need their safe space, right? But also at the same time, how do these people get included and integrated into the greater organization so that these conversations are not just, you know, at a point in time, but people can actually feel like, oh, I need to change my behavior, or that has definitely made me rethink some things, or whatever it may be, right? I mean, a lot to be said about, you know, again, DEI efforts and companies and corporations. But honestly, it's not just about corporations. Maybe companies can provide a safe space for people to just have very small group type of conversations where people are more open, and they just kind of, you know, they're okay answering any questions that you may have, right? And without taking any offense to it, because I think that's like the biggest thing, right? People don't want to offend another person. And in trying not to offend the other person, they just, you know, they end up offending them, right? Again, and I keep talking about college because those were some of the times where we were able to have these conversations a little bit more freely because we weren't confined by HR, right? So, right. You know, you were talking about comedy, doing comedy. And at the time, Dave Chappelle had a sketch and he had a bit where I think Wu-Tang Clan came out and they said, "Konnichiwa." And for a while, I couldn't go anywhere without someone yelling out "Konnichiwa."
Yeah.
In school.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? And or sometimes people would be like, "Ni hao." I'm like, none of them are my languages. Right. And the fact that you think that it's okay for you to yell out whatever language that you think you're speaking to me because I look like this is racist.
Yeah,
right?
For sure.
But funny story though, one of them actually asked a friend of mine, like, is that racist when I yell out "Konnichiwa"? And this wasn't a white man, this was a black man, right? He asked one of our friends, is that racist? And she was like, yeah. You know, just because you're not using the N word doesn't make it any less racist, right?
Yeah, and I think, you know, what you were kind of talking about earlier with, like, you know, creating a space to basically just talk and understand and almost kind of be able to ask the questions that normally might be met with a little bit of an eye roll. Like, I do understand there is a point a lot of people do need those questions answered, especially a particular age group. And I think that's where millennials tend to kind of almost be the cutoff for that, where, like, it's a bit of a gray area because, you know, Gen Z, I will say, love, and this is kind of just like based on my TikTok, but like Gen Z like loves to bash millennials a little bit. But I think what Gen Z doesn't understand is millennials really had to go through this sort of like a dawn of awakening for Gen Z to exist in the way that it does, which is this like more inherent understanding that we're all just people trying to just like do the best we can. But one of the things that was interesting is when it came to LGBTQIA, you know, affinity groups or events or whatever it was, that was the time that we would always like bring in someone from the outside, which always felt very strange to me because when it came to other panels, women, when it came to, you know, events that focus more on our Black coworkers or our Asian coworkers or Latinx. But when it came to like queer LGBTQIA, we were bringing in outside people. And it just always struck me as so strange because that we are a beauty company. There was no shortage of queer people walking around. And I also remember when the affinity groups came out, when they started sort of promoting them and getting people to join them, the only group that specifically labeled allies was the LGBTQIA one. And I've actually noticed that in other, NBC does that as well, because I follow NBC Jobs on Instagram, and they will post about their affinity groups, and all of them are like named something cute. And then there's always the LGBTQ one that always has allies included. And this is not to say that allies in any group are useless. Allies are great. But what I think I struggled with, and this was my initial sort of like resistance to ever joining it, was I don't need another space where allies are centered in a conversation. You know, and to me, including them in the title of the group was inviting them to center themselves. And I think that's where it's like allies need to create space and hold space, but it is not their job to fill in that space. And I think that was where, especially that summer of 2020, where, you know, George Floyd really was reigniting things with Black Lives Matter. We went a while, like we said last week, without ever saying anything as a company. We were all talking about it internally constantly. Every meeting, everything was dominated with that, which is not a bad thing. And especially depending on the neighborhood or the area that you lived in, because like you said, we were all working from home. This was very early on in COVID. Depending on where you lived, you could hear the protests and marches happening. There were some in my neighborhood. And, you know, some of them remained peaceful. Obviously, some of them did not remain peaceful. And I think that that was one of the things that I was recognizing was like the people that were speaking up tended to be non-Black, which again was fine, but we were able to sort of create space to say, okay, we finally got your attention, leaders, whoever. Now, here's some people that you need to hear from because you're not listening to anybody. Like, you're just doing your own thing. And I remember specifically being told, and it was a phrase I hate, but like, hold our feet to the fire. And we did. And nothing happened. Mm-hmm. So I think that's the frustration that comes out of like a DEI program and where people become apathetic is when leaders are telling you, okay, you know, we're hearing you, we see you, you make sure that we keep hearing you and seeing you, but then 6 months rolls by and the conversation's not in the media as much anymore. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly it's like we're backtracking and, yeah. You know, we don't care as much from a leader perspective. A group of us, a small group of us, which I did not lead, I just happened to be a part of a conversation that like turned into this, actually prepared a statement to put on our social media to say, we don't know what's going on. We don't like that no one's saying anything. Mm-hmm. And it does not reflect on us. Because the position a lot of us were in is we were sort of faces of the various brands that we worked on, mm-hmm. whether it was to our artists, to, you know, just hairdressers that knew us, or in my case, actually, I did media work. I did that kind of stuff that my face was sort of like associated with the brand at different times. And I never wanted people to like think that I was just not thinking about it or whatever. And so, you know, we basically wrote the statement, gave it to them to say, this is what's going to happen on this day if you can't make something happen. And sure enough, nothing happened. And so we posted it. I remember being very scared to do that because, you know, we were dealing with, you know, basically leaders in North America. But I, at one point, had even said something on, must have been like Workplace, to the president at the time, because they were saying like, oh, like, it's just so tragic. And, you know, we just have so much to do. And I remember being like, our like lack of inclusivity and lack of racial diversity in our advertisements is not a secret. This is not something we're just discovering. We have known this. We have been talking about this for years. And I even knew that we had been talking about it for years. Mm-hmm. And I remember I put that on Workplace, again, terrified to do so, because at the time I still, you know, was trying to build a career there. And she responded, and it basically tagged a couple of people who were leading the global DEI, mm-hmm. and said, hey, include this person. Mm-hmm. So I was like, oh, cool. Okay, I'm going to be included. I got a single email that was like, hey, we'll get in touch with you soon. And then never heard again. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if, again, I don't know if that's was a demographic thing, which is fine. I was not trying to take a space from someone else. I gladly would have given it up if they're like, we have too many people. But it was that notion of just like, it was not a priority. Oh. And I understand I was not speaking on behalf of a group I represented. I was fine with that. But after that, it was just, I saw the whole thing as a joke. Like, I didn't take any of it seriously anymore because I it was just the idea of like, okay, you publicly to the entire company wanted to make it seem like you were including me. Mm-hmm. I don't think there was ever an intention to include me. Yeah. And what's really interesting is the person that was in charge of like putting me on that team, we actually followed each other on social media at the time. We would talk once in a while. And the second I left, they unfollowed me, which I thought was really interesting. I didn't really think they knew who I was.
Yeah.
But they, I don't know how I noticed, but I somehow noticed that they unfollowed me really quickly. But
I think you bring up a good point about follow through. And, you know, we've mentioned it in the article before last week on why DEI efforts fail. And a lot of that have to do with the follow through, right? And you know, for us, we used to have town halls, right, and where we look at our quarterly results. Yeah. We looked at those numbers pretty carefully. I mean, that was just during the town hall. I feel like I looked at numbers really carefully to see how we were performing financially, and that was always on top of mind for me. But, you know, and I get it. You work for a for-profit company, and you have shareholders, you know, and you have board of directors that you need to answer to, so on and so forth. But if you cared about DEI, maybe even as half as you care about numbers,
exactly,
right? Do we think that it would have been in the state that it was in, right?
Yeah.
And even like creating events for things like that, right? I think for me personally, in the group that I was in, it almost became a little bit of, okay, well, what are some good things that we can share, right? Sure. So like there was at the time Lunar New Year celebration. Yeah. So, you know, we talked about how we celebrate Lunar New Year, and we made a video that we made for the company, which I think is great, right? However, you almost prettify what DEI is supposed to be as well, because with the good there comes the bad, exactly, right? And because you're talking about people and you're talking about the experiences that people have gone through, and not everything is good, right? And so I remember, you know, when we were talking about future events, I was like, you know, people can't just love our food, our music, our beauty trends, and then say, you know what, we don't care about the other part of it, right? You feel uncomfortable talking about elderly getting attacked.
Yeah.
You know, and you feel uncomfortable talking about how racism is bad. You're right. You can't just take the rainbows and the cotton candy and unicorns, right? You have to take it in as real life, because again, it is our identity, right? It's not just three letters of like used as an acronym, right? It is, you're talking about your people, and you know, in a culture, if you say you care about people and you accept people for who they are as an organization, then you're saying you accept me as me, not this polished version where I make part of myself invisible to make you feel comfortable.
Yeah. Well, and I think I remember that video distinctly, and I remember the whole time period, because this was a good 7-8 months at this point after George Floyd. And so I think a lot of us had seen the response, and a lot of us took it as like, okay, it's a step. Mm-hmm. It's something. Yeah. Like we're moving. And then I don't remember if this is before or after then they sort of just changed everything right back. Mm-hmm. And I mean, that was not even subtle. And they literally just said, like, we have too many people on the lead team. We have to make some cuts. And they basically cut all the people that they had added, plus some. They had cut some people that had been on the lead team for years already at that point. But I think what was especially maybe jarring when it came around to the Stop AAPI Hate was the realization that nothing had been learned. Nothing had been changed. And I think even just observing, because I obviously was not super involved in any of that, but observing what was going on, the conversations you and I were having, it was so frustrating because it was like, okay, so you've already sort of shown us that most of what we thought maybe was a thing is not a thing, whatever. Like, now you're just doubling down on it, because mm-hmm. how long did it even take to get a statement about that? It was weeks, I think.
And it was barely a statement.
It was, and it was shoved in, yes, because there was like a current activation going on for something else that that the person deciding was way more into.
It was not for the lack of trying, though.
It was not for the lack of trying.
It was an absolute shit show. Yeah. And, you know, we asked for a while, and then we started seeing all our competitors putting up messages. CEOs making a stand, and these are white male CEOs saying AAPI hate is bad.
Yeah,
I'm not even gonna get to who our CEO was because it is. I mean, you know, you that whole time was just you. Then you realize, like, oh, like you don't really value me,
right?
And I think for me, I go to work to get work done, right? Sure. Career is career, job is a job. And, you know, if I, and I'm there to get something done, right? But, and I've never felt like, yes, culture is important, but, you know, that it was going to be one of the make it or break it on staying with the culture. But apparently, you know, this was kind of the, like it was the cherry on top where I said, I can't do this anymore.
Yeah, that was the point where I was embarrassed, like, to work there. And I remember telling my HRBP, like, I probably shouldn't have said my HRBP, but someone in HR, that I was embarrassed to work there. And I remember them being like, well, why? Mm-hmm. And I was, I don't even... Like, this is only a 30-minute call. I don't have time to get into every reason I'm embarrassed to work here. But I just remember being like, our response to everything is either nothing or way too late. And
it's not even good.
And not even good. Because I do remember, the statement was literally just a statement. There was, I don't believe, any donation made, where that was, you know, some of the criticism is like the year prior there had been donations made to like NAACP, which again, I'm very happy about. But then the fact that all of a sudden that money seemed to have dried up was just ridiculous. And I think what you're saying about, like, you know, I take things a little less seriously about like shareholders and all, like, I, to be honest, don't really care. I don't care if some billionaire can buy a second yacht or can't buy a second yacht because, like, we didn't make our third quarter. Like, it does not matter to me. But you look stressed. But it was the lack of humanity. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where it got really, really hard. And that's where it was just like, as a marginalized person, I don't feel comfortable. I never felt unsafe, but it wasn't a safe place to be, because it was that idea of like, I do have a somewhat unique, you know, viewpoint because of whatever, but you're making it so clear that you don't really care about those unique viewpoints. You see these as hurdles to get over and not as like a thing to embrace or whatever. So, you know, with that, it's just, again, I don't know the solution here. I don't know if there is a solution. I don't know. I think what you're saying is correct. I think that to leave this up to corporations is honestly probably where we've gone very wrong. But, you know, I also think that probably the very corporations that resist these types of things are probably the same ones that also are funding the fact that we do have to keep this out of schools in some areas. And, you know, we talked a little bit about, like, I asked, was this related to critical race theory? And you said no. I actually disagree. I think it is actually related to critical race theory, because blocking that type of education, which you, I actually was honest, I didn't really know what it was. And you were like, well, that's more about the history. I was like, so it's just history? Like, are they just not teaching history in some areas? But, you know, they're not teaching it accurately, and it doesn't do anyone a favor to do that. And so, you know, all of that to just say, yeah, racism is bad.
Yes. Yes. Absolutely. And I think, you know, DEI, good effort, but, you know, corporate America, great idea. You know, now you need to go execute it, right? And unless there is a true, where people feel like they belong, and again, that inclusion happens, you know, you can have a brochure with, again, colors of the rainbow, but, you know, if you don't live your day-to-day living that life, living that culture, it's all moot.
Well, we are out of time, so you can follow us on Twitter at Corporate Rehab Pod, on Instagram at Corporate Rehab. I'm sorry, Twitter is Corporate Rehab Pod, on Instagram at Corporate Rehab Pod. Those will have more real-time thoughts, reactions, and just some fun stuff. And then please leave us a rating and review on whatever platform you're listening to us on. Thank you so much for joining us on our part two about DEI. We will see you next week.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you. Bye.